Thank you. Be seated.
Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioners in Faro versus Chambers County.
May it please the court, Mr. Richard Clarkson will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner will reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. This case appears not to have attracted the same crowd as the previous case. I think it's likewise an important case. And interesting enough, it's not a subject that comes up that much. There aren't that many appellate decisions dealing with jury misconduct and party misconduct as we have here. We come before this court this morning because we're claiming that this case has a significant public policy reasons that need to be discussed, and also because what occurred in the trial court violates some strong stare decisis rules. I think that this is a good time to argue this case because we've all just finished listening and to the O.J. Simpson case. We're all aware of the discussions going on TV and in the print media about the integrity of the jury system and the court system. We see that there's a division between the black community and the white community on certain things, certain aspects of the case. And this brings us to the important public policy questions in this case. For instance, to use racial epithets in court has always been held to be ipso facto wrong and something that's incurable. And in this case involving the simple things like giving aspirin or giving a Coke or giving a ride in a vehicle has required reversal of these cases.
Some, although by no means all of your cases, do date from an era before the harmless error rule was firmly entrenched in our jurisprudence.
Yes, and that's interesting. There are a lot of cases, and a lot of them, as the court suggests, are early cases. The McCaslin court, and I think it was Justice Norvell who said that with the passage of this rule, that the courts would still look to prior cases to stare decisis in ruling on these questions. And I think one of the important reasons, if perhaps even in the rule itself, which says that the jurors in Rule 327 may not testify about what influenced them or not, although they can testify about outside events that occur. So I think it's a good rule and maintains its viability that there are certain kinds of action that the courts simply hold by long, long tradition, going back certainly before even Blackstone and carried over to this country, that certain kinds of activities raise an appearance of impropriety of such a nature that a new trial is required. And the courts in Texas, in federal courts, hold that you cannot look behind these kinds of activities, that it is human nature that the jurors will say, or the parties, the witnesses say, oh, well, this didn't bother me. You know, they did say this or they did do that, but we weren't affected by it.
Should the same rule apply across the board? Let's say that the same case had come up and it involved the Dallas Independent School District and a gentleman had been a teacher in the Dallas Independent School District. Should we apply the same scrutiny or the same test that you say we should apply in this case to that kind of situation?
What did the teacher do?
Did under the same facts, had lunch with, had dinner with?
Well, yes, I think if the school district was a defendant in the case and the teacher took out a juror to have lunch or dinner in this case, there appears to have been a romantic relationship, so there was a lot of meals. And they also went across the street to the sheriff's department, had coffee during the trial. I think so. And I think what this court is the guardian of the appearance of propriety, the guardian of the integrity of the court.
So it wouldn't make any difference how remote the employee was if he were, say, in this case, a gent. Same result.
Yes, and I think the job, Your Honor, is the court's job, as Justice O'Connor says in her dissent. The rule says the trial court, shall instruct the jury on this matter and explain to them exactly what is involved.
Why does it make any difference that they actually went to dinner if they were romantically involved? Wouldn't that be a problem in and of itself?
Well, I think it might heighten the need for scrutiny, because this man is working, as Justice O'Connor says in her dissent, this is a small county with a small sheriff's department.
So if they've been dating steadily for a long period of time, but the juror didn't go out with the fellow for a few days or hours during the trial case, that wouldn't be a problem.
Well, of course, what the court is making, a technical point, it would be a problem. No one, because they've suspended an activity for a few days or two, or probably going to change their heart or their tendencies. I think that the lady in question, Ms. Pilant, would certainly be concerned about whether or not her boyfriend or would-be husband is going to lose his job. But I think these kind of cases ought to be looked at in a unique way, and that is that historically, and I invite the court to look at the Crawford opinion by United States Supreme Court. Historically, the courts have taken great care to protect the jury system. And I think we're talking about here not about situation ethics or practicalities, that sort of thing. I think the court has set out historically certain rules that are to be honored and to be enforced regardless of the fact that one might say, or people in the street might say, oh, well, you know, that wasn't really a problem. My experience is that really wouldn't have changed anything. The court says, as it says in Crawford, that the courts cannot look behind these kind of situations. You know, we're all born humans. We're taught that we all were born with original sin. We all have the tendency toward the venality. We all have the tendency to justify ourselves when caught on the carpet. We all have the tendency to say, oh, well, it wouldn't influence me. And the court said, unless you can show absolute corruption, there's no way to really get behind to see if this, in fact, did affect the outcome of the jury. And of course, this is the outcome of the case, and this is a 10-2 verdict.
Would you agree that if you had a juror that you could strike for cause, but that you didn't ask the questions on voir dire that would bring this out, you can waive that objection to the juror?
In this instance, I don't know if your question is hypothetical, but
it is. Would you agree with me that you can waive a right to strike a juror for cause by not asking the proper questions on voir dire, for example?
Yes, I think it is. I think in this situation that you could, because the judge's instructions to the jury were clear. The Court of Appeals, in its opinion, did not rule that there was any kind of a waiver. They discussed the instructions to the judge and the evidence and so forth. They simply held that this deputy sheriff was too remote as an employee from the facts of the case.
On voir dire, the juror volunteered that she knew the sheriff and other members of the sheriff's department. Is that correct?
Yes.
And there were no follow-up questions to explore the extent of that relationship or how she knew him. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. But again, if you will look at this county, I don't know where you grew up, but in Beaumont, most people say they know the sheriff. Certainly in Chambers County, most people will say they knew the sheriff. To exclude from the jury those who knew the sheriff might empty the courthouse.
But she knew, she volunteered that she knew others in the sheriff's department, not just the sheriff.
And she identified another sheriff's deputy. There was no statement about the fact that she was dating a deputy sheriff or anything like that.
If they'd been married, should they just have to live apart for the time that she's on the jury?
Well, as a practical matter, Your Honor, I don't think she should serve on the jury.
Well, but no one asked her. She got on the jury, and the trial court instructions have nothing to do with the party in this case. Your view is that she couldn't go home.
My view, and the view of the Court of Appeals and of Justice O'Connor, was that the jury was instructed on this. In fact, the witness herself said when they received that instruction, she knew that she wasn't supposed to talk to the sheriff. She knew she wasn't supposed to talk to the people there, to the sheriff's employees who were involved in this fatal occurrence. She knew that she wasn't supposed to talk to anyone who was an employee of the sheriff's department at the time of these events.
So I guess your answer is, if they'd been married, she just couldn't go home.
Well, if she got on the jury, and the parties knew about this relationship, I suppose there could be a waiver of it. But if she got on the jury under the court's instruction, she should avoid contact with her husband and talking about the case, so forth.
But how are we going to know if they talk about the case? She says they didn't.
Yes, but
all that's irrelevant here. But if they were married, it wouldn't be irrelevant. We look at their testimony.
But the cases set out in the briefs, Your Honor, show a long line of cases that hold that, and McCaslin says that it's not important.
So we fully open, can we talk for a minute about the Bailiff's remark?
Yes. And before I do that, Your Honor, I do want to say that the Texas decisions hold that an employee should not be on the jury. It doesn't say an employee who was involved or an employee that works on the same floor or somebody involved or anything like that. It's across the board prohibition.
But this deputy sheriff was not on the jury, and that is distinguished in fact.
Well, it's distinguished in this way. If you can't be on the jury, then you certainly cannot be dating jurors and going out and having meals and inviting the jurors over for coffee.
That leads me to my next question. Are you arguing that McCaslin dictates, in the case of jury misconduct, a no harm analysis but reversible error, period?
There has to be the courts say that there is a presumption of harm.
Do you construe that to mean it's without a harm analysis and that's all the further you could go, or is it a rebuttable presumption?
No, I don't think it's rebuttable in these lines of cases. I think if this
you
court...
You don't think it's rebuttable?
That's right. I think in these
what
lines...
What about Strange versus Treasure City, this court's 1980? Decision.
Well, I think in the McCaslin case...
No, what about Strange versus Treasure City, the 1980 case? McCaslin is the what? 1958 case.
What was the activity in Strange that was the subject?
Well, I'm asking you about the standard of review, not the activity.
I think that the dissent of Justice O'Connor in all the cases...
No, you hadn't answered my question yet.
I'm not able to make a distinction, right, if that's what you're asking me.
All right, thank you.
And that's not because there isn't one. I'm just not, have not read that case. So please don't take my remark as...
what the respondent relied on.
I consider the case that the principal case that the respondent relied upon, Your Honor, as the Honeycutt versus Clark case, which is, if you'll notice in there, the distinction is that nothing happened along the lines that we're talking about here, which is food, drink, meals, rides in automobiles, coffee at the sheriff's department, and so forth. Now, to go back to the Chief Justice...
Your time has expired.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I waive my question.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Figure it out from the race. Any other questions? Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Mr. Mike Baker will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, I found no case in which a juror's relationship to the employee of a multi-employee defendant is disqualification for the juror as a matter of law. Nor have I found a statute that holds that. Given that fact, the standard of review in this case should be one for a typical misconduct case, and that would mean that the trial judge's findings with regard to misconduct should be binding on this court. And of course, we know that Judge Welborn determined that there was no misconduct.
Should the standard of review be abuse of discretion?
Yes, Your Honor. And in our brief, we cited, I think, a good case that discusses the standard review, the Solis versus Saints case, which is out of Corpus Christi Court. In fact, Juror Plant did not commit misconduct. She answered every question that was asked of her on voir dire honestly. When she was asked about who she knew in the Sheriff's Department, she stated she knew them and how she knew them. She was not asked about this particular sheriff's deputy and therefore had no reason to tell anyone about her relationship with this particular deputy. In the hearing on the motion for new trial, there was no evidence that her contacts with Deputy Sheriff Collier led to any sort of any discussion of the case, or that there was any sort of influence brought to bear during the jury deliberations, such as an outside influence. And there's just no evidence to suggest that this relationship resulted in misconduct. That
do you concede that if the sheriff had bought her coffee, that might be a different case?
That might be a different case.
County commissioner?
That might be a different case.
Why would it be a different case?
Because...
If she testified, that didn't have any influence on my verdict.
Because the sheriff was directly involved in this case.
Well, the county, was involved in the case.
The county was involved in the case, and, of course, hypothetically...
It's an employee of the county who... Her boyfriend was an employee of the county.
He was a deputy sheriff. He worked under the sheriff. But he was not involved in the case. He was not employed by the sheriff's department at the time this incident occurred, was not involved in any investigation.
My question, I guess, maybe for me to be more specific, was Judge Hecht asked you if somebody had bought her coffee. And is that because we presume harm from that contact with the juror?
If it is an employee, in my view, if you have a multi-employee defendant, such as a sheriff's department or a corporation, if one of the persons involved in the incident that is the subject matter of the case or is present at the trial buys coffee or has some improper conduct or contact with a juror, that to me would be misconduct.
Is that because we presume harm? Not what, because if the,
I'm not
the,
sure
if the juror testifies and all the testimony is, that didn't have any influence on my decision in this case.
I don't.
How do we get past the harmful error?
I don't think you can presume harm, because I have seen cases in which a corporate representative had a conversation with a juror during the trial that was ruled to be a harmless contact.
So we're asking about buying coffee for the juror, which has been held to necessitate a new trial. And my question is, how do you reconcile that with a harmful error analysis? And it sounds like what I'm speculating is that we presume harm in some circumstances. Now, are you saying this is just, this employee is too remote from the party?
Yes, yes.
Okay. But do you agree under some circumstances we do presume harm?
In some of the older cases, that is has been the law, and I haven't seen that those cases have been overruled. The McCashman case is an example.
What about the bailiff's comments?
Your Honor, the bailiff's comments were off the cuff. They were not directed to any particular issue in this case. It was during, I think it was before Fort Dyer had started. He said one of his friends, high school friends who had to be on the panel, asked him about the jury cards. And his comment was, well, if you're going to talk about spending money on jury cards, you're going to talk about raising taxes. And some other people in the panel overheard that. Everybody laughed.
What is a jury card?
To be honest, I don't know if they were talking about the cards that go on the lapels or if they were talking about some other card. But
was there a clear implication of liability? If they found liability as the county, that the taxes would have to be raised?
No, that he never said that. And I don't think you can read that into the comments that he made. He was talking specifically about the context within the context of these jury cards. And I think to say that you can read into that that he's saying that the county's if you find against the county you're going to have to raise taxes is taking this beyond the stretch of any analysis.
What about his comment to the Houston lawyer to that effect?
That took place in the judge's chambers. I don't see how that's relevant to anybody. She solicited his view of what the case was about and what he thought was going to happen. And I don't see how that can bear on what the jury did or didn't do. I mean, that was in the judge's chambers away from the jury. I mean, I've certainly been in many situations where bailiffs have said much worse than that about my case or my opponent's case. But as long as it's not communicated to the jury, I don't think there's a problem.
May I take you back to the distinction that I think you were making about the remoteness of the connection of the party's employee?
Mm-hmm.
Is there, and I think you told Justice Heck that it was the county commissioner or the sheriff himself that might have been different, but because this was a deputy sheriff, then it was too remote from the party. Is there any, what sort of principle can we apply to this remoteness argument? Is there, what I'm wondering is, do we have to take all these on a case-by-case basis, or do we, if the sheriff or the county commissioner is enough to necessitate a reversal, but a deputy sheriff is not, what's the defining principle?
Well, I think the principle is that which is embodied in Rule 327, which is to leave it with the trial court's discretion unless you have a situation in which one of the parties, or in one of these situations where you've got a corporation or a police department or the Dallas Independent School District, unless you've got the witness or the corporate representative who makes some sort of, does some sort of special favor for a juror.
So you would just, any kind of juror contact would be outside, would not be reversible unless it was giving them a ride or buying them a cup of coffee.
I'm not saying any, it is one of the individuals involved in the case for the company or the sheriff's department. And there is some contact that has to be evaluated, whether it's an off-the-cuff comment versus some special favor, that might be, there might be a distinction between the two.
Of course, we can't know, and I guess the trial judge couldn't know what exactly transpired between the deputy sheriff and the juror, other than what they saw fit to reveal.
Well, at the hearing on the motion for a new trial, they did testify, and they said they went to lunch and dinner a couple of times and didn't talk about the case. We can presume, I mean, sure, you can assume that they weren't truthful or that there was more discussion.
What I'm struggling with is how we reconcile the presumption of harm where they buy a cup of coffee, but we have a different rule with regard to harm analysis when it's juror contact that doesn't involve buying somebody a cup of coffee, where they're the only two people who are present, and it's not possible other than through their mouths to find out what they say happened. How much of that we can tolerate without creating an appearance that somebody got to the jury and that resulted in a verdict that would have been different if they hadn't gotten in touch with them?
Well, the first question you have to ask yourself is whether this particular deputy sheriff, employee, whatever, had anything to do with the case. If they weren't involved in the case, then I can't think of anything that would be harmful in terms of conduct other than if they tried to bribe the juror. I mean, in the area where I try lawsuits, it is common to have the spouses of employees of corporations on juries and not be stricken for cause, unless they're stockholders in the company.
You keep saying the remoteness of the deputy sheriff in this case, but we're not talking about deputy sheriff misconduct. We're talking about juror misconduct.
Yes, ma'am.
And it's your position that there was no juror misconduct here?
That's right. There was no juror misconduct.
Going into the sheriff's office and having coffee in the sheriff's office when this case involved, the party was the county, but it was there because of the conduct of the sheriff's deputies. Isn't that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you see nothing, no misconduct, whether it's harmless or harmful, of a juror going into the sheriff's office at a break in the trial?
No, Your Honor.
Does the record show who bought her the coffee in the sheriff's office?
The record in the motion for new trial, the coffee was not provided by the county. It was apparently one of the other deputies who's identified. It was their coffee pot.
It was their coffee pot in the sheriff's office, right, that right. Somebody poured her a cup of coffee out of.
Right.
And does the record doesn't show who it is that paid for it?
I think that one of the deputy sheriffs that she was talking to, also not involved in this case. But I mean, there's a coffee pot in the jury room that the county provides. I don't see that as misconduct. The county is paying the jurors to come there every day.
So what if they had a buffet lunch for jurors in the sheriff's office? Would you see a problem with that? While the sheriff was a defendant in the case and the county was on trial?
That gives me some discomfort. If the sheriff's department had invited the jury over for a buffet lunch, it causes me concern.
Why should it if there's no presumed harm?
Well, all I'm saying is that it's something that I would look askance at. I'm not sure that I would necessarily conclude that it was harmful.
Mr. Baker, would that be more in line with misconduct of the parties rather than misconduct of the jury?
Yes, Your Honor. It would be. That would have been something solicited by a party for the jury. All right. Let me, I think I've reached or I've made most of the comments I wanted to make, but to kind of conclude here, I think that Judge Welborn's analysis of this was correct. I think the Court of Appeals analysis of this was correct. I don't want to retry this case, but I must say that if I understand what the petitioner is asking for here, It would mean that in cases, in counties, where you have one or two large employers, the spouses of employees, remote employees, are automatically disqualified. Because here we have a farther relationship or a more distant relationship than the husband and wife relationship.
If the spouse, if this juror had been married to an employee of the county, would that have appeared on the juror information card? Mm-hmm. So even if counsel hadn't asked the question, it would have
been on the juror.
Apparent.
But the second situation is, let's say in voir dire, I stand up and say, okay, I represent Chevron Corporation, and these are the witnesses that are going to testify for Chevron and were involved in this case. John Doe, Jim Smith, Bob White, and no one on the jury knows these individuals. But at some point later during the trial or after the trial, I find out that a juror is rooming with an employee of Chevron. That has not been the law in the state, that person is automatically disqualified, or that results in jury misconduct. And I think the logical extension of what petitioners are asking for leads to that, and I think it's going to make it awfully hard for, it would make it awfully hard to see juries in counties where there are one or two employees, or where you have defendants that have a big presence. And as I say, even in Chambers County, where you have a small sheriff's department, Sheriff Morris was a lame duck at the time this case had been tried. I couldn't find out how the jurors voted. I couldn't ask the panel members, do you vote for him or against him? And there are things that are just inherent in this type of case involving a county that are going to be there. And with one or two more questions on voir dire, I think, to Ms. Palan about did you know anybody else in the Sheriff's Department, this could be resolved. This would have been resolved. And even if the questions had been asked, I don't think the judge would necessarily disqualify her for knowing a deputy sheriff who was not involved in the case.
Well, even if they had asked the question, do you know anybody else in the Sheriff's Department, and she'd said, yeah, I date one of the sheriff's deputies, would that have cured or given the subsequent conduct, if in fact the subsequent conduct is a problem? I mean, assume the argument is that just because you know this sheriff's deputy, that doesn't disqualify your dating him. But we say that certain contacts with an employee of a party is a problem. Just the fact she knew him or was dating him would not disqualify her. Is anybody
no.
arguing that?
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ken.
I think the law is clear in Texas that the test is, did certain events occur or not occur? And perhaps, Judge, this is the distinction you're referring to in the Strange case, is whether or not the event occurred or not. That's a fact question. Now, the witnesses at the motion for new trial hearing admitted that the events occurred. Now, the next question is harm presumed? Or is there a further inquiry as to whether or not there was any harm? Now, the cases in Texas and the federal cases, which are in the brief, say as a matter of public policy, the courts do not ask whether or not harm occurred. That if that were the case, they would have to show, it would be impossible, for instance, as the Clote case says, to show a harmful result with certainty is practically impossible, short of proof of actual corruption or the most gross impropriety. Again, the Matthews case cites all the long precedent and says that the parties were permitted to excuse improper conduct of this character. This was buying food and cigars for a juror. On the grounds that no wrong was intended and probably no injury was done, it would be impossible to draw the line anywhere short of absolute corruption. We are unwilling to lend encouragement to practices which, if tolerated, would undermine the purity and efficiency of our jury system. And they go on to state other sentiments along those lines. Now, it seems to me what we're doing here is backing away in arguments from an absolute prohibition to one where we're going to have a sort of gradualism. If the child moves away from the home, is it all right for him to be on the jury if his parents are appointed? If the employee is working for a different department, is it all right? If the subsidiary is being sued, is it all right for the parent company to have a hospitality room for the jurors? Is it all right for this? Is it all right for that? So that it's going to be eaten away. And the premise behind the whole argument, which is human nature is corruptible, human nature is venal, we can't get behind all this to protect the integrity of the system, we're going to have across-the-board prohibition. Then you say we're going to get rid of all that. And we're now going to start to second guess. We're going to look to see this obscure idea of remoteness. And then, you know, really, to me, is there really any proof that it affected them?
Mr. Clarkson, let me ask you a question to answer. How would you answer Mr. Baker's argument that in a small county, like the counties are, that everybody knows everybody and they're usually related? And,
right.
Couple that with
what I'm saying.
The standard of review is abuse of discretion. Would you argue, would you differ or take issue that the standard of review for us is abuse of discretion?
I think the standard must be the presumption of harm. Otherwise, you begin to second guess, just like the racial epithet argument.
How would you write an opinion? I would, if you were, if it was up to you, what would the opinion say to give guidance?
Yes, sir.
And it would be binding on all 254 counties.
I would say that the court finds that these events occurred because the witnesses have acknowledged that they did.
And when you talk about these events, what specifically are you referring to?
Having lunches and dinners, spending times on weekends together, going over to the sheriff's department and having coffee, having this kind of intimate relationship.
What would you say about the bailiff?
About
the bailiff. The bailiff.
Well, again,
the argument is that statement has been taken out of context, that what the bailiff was in reference to was some sort of a jury card, and that's what he was talking about.
Well, I don't think it was taken out of context, and if you take the remark literally, he is telling this jury that these little juror cards, which tell them their duties and so forth, and evidently have been used in a number of cases and were getting worn, he is saying literally, if you take that literally, that if you want us to get you new jury cards, we're going to have to raise taxes. Now, one could second guess and say, oh, you know, well, he's just joking. But there are subtle messages there, just like in a racial epithet or could be a subtle message. And the point is, if you take that literally, is he telling the jury, in effect, that if you award damages for these plaintiffs against the county, we're going to have to do the same thing?
Mr. Clarkson, I take it your answer, just to wrap this up, you disagree with the standard of review for us is abuse of discretion. You say when these types of events occur as a matter of law, there's jury misconduct and a story.
Yes, the cases say that the courts will not go behind to determine motivation or effect of the remarks on the jurors or the parties that are involved.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes this argument and concludes the morning's submission docket. The marshal will please adjourn the court.
Counsel, please rise. Oh, yay, oh, yay, oh, yay. The Honorable Court of Texas.